Welcome to the Renegade Inc. podcast. This is the audio version of our weekly talk show hosted by Ross Ashcroft.
Welcome to Renegade Inc., the show that allows us to think differently. George Orwell famously said, "Journalism is printing what someone else does not want printed. Everything else is public relations." In a world festooned with PR exercises and reputation management, was Mr. Orwell overly cynical, or was he well ahead of his time? With print media's business model in freefall, newspaper proprietors are increasingly desperate to find ways to ensure financial viability. The problem with this approach is that corporate interests can, and often do, trump the interests of readers. Joining me to discuss how free the UK press really is are the lecturer in journalism and media studies at Birkbeck College, Justin Schlossberg, and the editor of Open Media at Open Democracy, James Cusick. Gentlemen, welcome. Start with you, Justin, from an academic point of view, from an observer's point of view, how free is the UK press at the moment?
Well, I think the first thing to consider is what we mean by free. I think in the kind of conventional narrative of the liberal press, freedom of the press has always meant freedom from state control, state intervention, state influence. I think we need to take a much broader view of what a free press means, including freedom from, for example, corporate and commercial pressures that can be just as corruptive of journalism's social purpose and its contribution to democratic life.
When we look through that prism, is that corporate influence as pernicious as it seems to be?
Peter Oborne probably said it best when he resigned from the Daily Telegraph in 2014 because ostensibly, according to him, the Telegraph wouldn't allow him to publish the stories that he wanted to publish, particularly in regards to the embroiling scandal surrounding HSBC at the time, which happened to be one of the Telegraph's biggest account holders. And in his resignation letter, he said very clearly that what we have seen in recent years, as your introduction suggested, with the rise of the intensifying commercial pressures on newspapers, we've seen the emergence of what he called shadowy executives who determine what truths can and can't be told across the press. And I think the reality is this is not just affecting newspapers, it's happening in broadcasters sometimes for different reasons, but you know, the BBC has been under all sorts of financial pressures for a long time, and it's very clear that there is also a kind of climate of caution that has surrounded BBC News and current affairs. And the reality is a journalism that is not risky is not real journalism.
Business models in decline and journalists not taking risks anymore. Is that the cause and effect?
It is. I would take exception with one thing. I think we have a relatively free press. What we also have, which is, say, different from the 20s or 30s, is a press under great scrutiny. We've had, you know, decades of the rich proprietor, the press barn, all of those things that were, you know, notorious, and you owned a newspaper for its influence. You didn't own a newspaper because it was going to make you a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So the Beaverbrooks and, the great men of journalism. At one point, you know, there was just as much commercial influence there as there is at the moment, but there was an awful lot less scrutiny.
Scrutiny from where?
I think scrutiny from investigative journalists. I think scrutiny from the public who want to know that if they're buying a newspaper, that newspaper is, there's a division of church and state inside that newspaper, a division between the editorial content, which is meant to be free, independent, and driven by the journalists.
And that's the church.
And that's the and then whatever division you want to make it, and advertising, which is, you know, the part of when you buy a newspaper, that's what drove the wealth of newspapers. Now, with the arrival of the internet, that classic business model, which was only ever about the delivery of money and revenue through circulation, the money you paid for the paper, plus the content and advertising in it. Well, the advertising is in free fall. The internet have taken care of that. And if you like, the internet sites that are accompanying each newspaper don't make the money that they were predicted to make. So what do you do if your business model is broken? Mm. Well, what you do is you invent, or you try to invent, another stream of income. And we've now got to a stage where what in the industry is known as sponsored content or native content. It means that you can badge stuff up to look as if it's the news, but it's not technically news because that part of the newspaper is bought and paid for. And that's the big debate, and that's what I meant by scrutiny.
But that's where the trust capital within readers is lost, isn't it? When something is badged or dressed as something and it isn't actually what it seems.
I sort of take a slightly different approach to the history, really. In fact, I just think that things haven't changed all that much in terms of newspaper power. I think the first thing to remember is that newspaper revenues have actually been in steady decline pretty much since the late 1950s, since the introduction of television. Yeah. So, yes, there's been the internet had a somewhat catalytic effect, but actually the entire business model of newspapers really has always been about a progressive consolidation, cuts to news gathering resources, cuts to editorial content in favour of making more space for advertising, more sensationalism, more and more infotainment, whatever you want to call it. This has been going on for decades. And the reality is, what motivates people to own newspapers today, I think, is still not that different from what motivated them in the era of Beaverbrooks.
You mean political power?
It's political power and influence. I think it's no surprise that the two most frequent visitors to number 10 and number 11 Downing Street, based on a piece of research that we did leading up to the announcement of the Fox Sky merger in 2016, the two most frequent visitors was Murdoch on the one hand, or his News Corp executives, and on the other hand is Lebedev, who owns independent print newspapers. So it's insidious, and probably the most destructive manifestation of this was the very recent decision not to carry out or to complete the Leveson inquiry, which was supposed to get to the bottom of the phone hacking scandal. That phone hacking scandal was so much more than just phone hacking. It was one of the greatest webs of institutional corruptions I think we've ever seen in this country. It embroiled elements of the police, politicians, along with media that extended well beyond News of the World and even beyond Murdoch's. And that's something, surely, that every journalist in their right mind would want to dig the truth out of.
The current Secretary of State, Matt Hancock, made a statement to the House of Commons, and he told the House of Commons that Lord Justice Leveson didn't want the second part of the Leveson inquiry. And then he was interviewed and said that was just a complete lie. And his response was, maybe I could have said that differently. So there's not so much an institutional barrier against this. There's almost political reasons why the second part of Leveson doesn't want to go ahead.
Right. So how free, if that is the case, and yes, if there are those entrenched political strategic moves, how free is this press?
There are journalists, I'm sure, working for newspapers across the tabloid serious spectrum, who would say that they're completely free to report whatever they want to report. But I think that the reality is we have to look at freedom as much more than just what you're told to do and not to do. You have to look at what is the actual institutional culture that exists within these news organizations, within these newsrooms. What are the kinds of day-to-day, subtle, almost imperceptible pressures that journalists face that can direct them away from particular stories and towards others? This notion that somehow the British press was free between somewhere in the 18th century and 2012 when we had the Leveson inquiry, it's just nonsense.
You're a seasoned veteran. You've been in newsrooms all over the country for many, many years.
I would defend the profession, actually. A profession, it's not a profession, but I would defend the practice of journalists. I think most journalists want to tell it as it is. Self-censorship is kind of crazy. News desks still have lots of power. And it's almost like, where does the instructions come from?
Right. You know, where do they come from?
Well, is it a rich proprietor who said, we would rather not have that in my paper, and everybody else follows that route all the way down?
Does that happen?
It does. I've been on the receiving end of that. I have carried out a lengthy investigation. I have left the newspaper thinking that this was going to be the front page of the paper, and have come back the following day and found the story to be nowhere. And I know that that story disappeared because the proprietor of the newspaper didn't want it in the paper.
So they have meddled. They have come in and spied.
They have.
Albeit subtly.
Subtly and rare. This is not routine. Hmm. This is far from routine. And again, I would say it's no different from what Beaverbrook and The Express did in the 30s and the 40s, where they didn't want to see stories. The difference now, I think, is that, say perhaps it's not necessarily a story that you wish to have in the paper, but there's an instruction that we would like you to do this way. And I know of one senior journalist who was asked to put his name to, effectively, it was a series of articles that he knew was bought and paid for. And he said, look, I'd rather not do this. This is going to damage my reputation as a journalist. If you're a young journalist coming in and you're trying to stay there, you're trying to establish a reputation, how do you say no to that?
But I think that we also in this country, in terms of press freedom, have a peculiar culture of deference towards not really a corporate agenda as much as actually a state agenda. And I'm thinking particularly here of the security state. And I think one of the most astonishing ways in which this shows its face is the Snowden leaks that were reported by The Guardian in 2013, which came right off the back of The Guardian's phone hacking coverage. And at that point, under Adam Rusbridger, The Guardian was very much seen as beyond the pale of Fleet Street.
And he was the then editor.
Yeah. And what you had is this utterly bizarre situation where you had editors, for example, like then editor of The Independent, Chris Blackhurst, penning editorials saying things like, if the security services say that I shouldn't report this, who am I to question their judgment?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm going to go that because I followed up part of that story as a journalist at The Independent under Chris Blackhurst.
Yeah.
And there was no question of anything that I wrote or investigated along with my colleagues not being published.
Sure.
But the point
so
you're
there
making...
There wasn't censorship inside The Independent at that time at all.
But the censorship that I'm talking about is not the necessarily measurable in the kind of micro context that you're talking about in terms of your personal experience. What I'm talking about is this dominant narrative that emerged and that was pushed by editors like Chris Blackhurst in conjunction with and collaboration with the Daily Mail, the Murdoch Press, which was...
I think you're being overly conspiratorial.
Well, it's not conspiratorial. If you look at the actual editorials at the time that were published, they were systematically not just critical of the Snowden leaks, but deeply critical of The Guardian for covering it in the first place and for not being deferential enough to the demands of the security state.
I didn't buy that, sorry.
Well, I mean, there's studies done on this. I mean, okay. I'm not saying that in the reportage, titles like The Independent didn't report on the Snowden leaks. They did. Some of the reporting, I have to say, was problematic in ways that kind of sought to undermine The Guardian in a different way by sort of claiming in one instance that they had an exclusive access to the leaks when apparently they didn't. But beyond that, there's no question that newspapers lined up, pulled rank, left, right and centre from the broadsheets of the tabloids to wage war over The Guardian on this issue. Now, what happened as a result of that? After Rusbridger left, Catherine Viner took over. What we've seen in The Guardian is a falling into line, is a pulling rank with Fleet Street. That is why The Guardian, the newspaper that exposed phone hacking in the first place, was also not calling for the completion of the Leveson inquiry, was also complicit in a massive cover-up, which is astonishing for The Guardian newspaper. So to come back to your original question, is the press free in this country? I would say it doesn't look like it from where I'm standing.
Yeah, I think maybe you need to go to some other countries quickly and find out what actually an unfree press looks like.
Well, I've been to other countries with unfree press. Okay. And yes, it is manifestly different. Yeah. And of course, in more autocratic regimes, you have much more state control. But the whole point that I was making in the first place is that press freedom is not just about state control. In a funny sort of way, if you look at the history of the British press, what happened when the government repealed things like stamp duty and censorship laws that were imposed on the press is not that the press suddenly became free, but it was a transfer of control from the state to the market. And in fact, if you look at the work done by people like James Curran, it's very clear that the so-called emancipation of the British press in the 18th century actually marked the death of the working class press, of the actual real kind of alternative voice at the time. We need to really get beyond this very simplistic idea that press freedom is about whether or not the government steps on your toes. It's much more than that.
If you're enjoying this podcast, join us at renegadeinc.com.
Welcome back to Renegade Inc., the show that allows us to think differently. Before we talk more about the not-so-free press with media academic Justin Schlossberg and journalist James Cusick, let's have a look at what you've been tweeting about in this week's Renegade Inc. Index. First up, we've got a tweet from John O'Brennan. The class system in Britain is alive and well in a newspaper associated with progressive politics. Now, this is The Guardian, and these are the writers that attended Oxbridge. And as you can see, gentlemen, apart from Suzanne Moore, who was at Middlesex, there is some cognitive capture there.
That doesn't surprise me. I would actually even think maybe only one or two colleges would be responsible for the whole thing, never mind the university.
Next, we've got a tweet from Andy Valeri. Media consolidation is even worse in the UK than the US. Typically, similar results politically. Around 70% of Britain's newspapers are owned by just three companies: Rupert Murdoch's News UK, the Daily Mail's General Trust, and Trinity Mirror. In broadcast media, over 80% of the national audience share goes to Murdoch or to the BBC.
Sometimes people forget that because we've got social media, because we've got Twitter, because we've got the rise of the so-called fifth estate and these kind of leftist online news platforms like the Canary, that somehow none of this stuff matters anymore. But I think actually all the evidence points to the contrary, that actually newspapers still have a huge amount of influence on both the public and the political agenda.
Finally, a tweet from Lisa Johnson. She's quoting Mr. John Pilger. I've been a journalist for many years. I've never known such corruption of my craft. It is as if a world of illusions has consumed the last vestiges of honest media in the cause of decaying power, its wars and witch hunts. And Pilger said that on the 17th of June. 2018. What's your immediate reaction to that?
John Pilger is one of the best journalists of his generation and wrote large parts of his stuff in the Daily Mirror. You probably couldn't quite imagine a John Pilger exclusive in the Mirror these days, and that means a slight decline. And there's also a decline in investigative journalism on its own. That means a story that has an agenda of its own that is not following any news agenda on the back of what we're saying and is looking at, maybe in John's case, an international problem. Those things cost a lot of money to send a journalist abroad, to spend time, to not know what the outcome of the story is going to be, and that takes faith and investment.
When we talk about business model and we talk about Pilger and we talk about investigations, you recently have conducted an investigation which is directly linked to a business model and how that is rethinking itself, if you like. Tell us how you first got wind of it and what you found.
We, on Open Democracy, published a story that showed that ESI, which is the Evening Standard, the company that owns the Evening Standard.
And what is the Evening Standard?
The Evening Standard is London's evening newspaper. It's a free sheet. It's supposed to be distributed, read by 900,000 in London. So it's an important newspaper. It has a strong political agenda. It has a good financial base as well. It's read by the city. It's an important paper, and it's currently under the editorship of the former Chancellor, George Osborne. We found that there had been a blurring of the what we referred to earlier as the church state, a blurring between independent editorial and advertising. This was a project called London 2020, which was supposed to be about six individual packages, everything from housing to IT to schools. And for £500,000 buy-in, £500,000, any commercial company was effectively being promised favourable comment and positive news. Now, this was part of a presentation, a PowerPoint presentation, which we managed to obtain.
And who generated the PowerPoint presentation?
Well, it would be ESI Media themselves. This was their offer, if you like, of what happened. Now, the standard parts of this presentation that are routine, it was some sponsored content, it would be exhibitions, it would be articles in the Evening Standard that were branded. In other words, readers would know what this was.
Right.
And in the industry, that is nothing new, and there is no reason to write about it.
And there's nothing really wrong with that.
There's nothing wrong about it.
As long as
an industry is losing £10 billion over the last 7-8 years in trying to find a new income stream, then there's nothing wrong with them finding an income stream by inventing a new form of advertising.
Provided that they tell readers that that's what they're
doing. Right. So this is what potential people paying $500,000 were asked. This is what you would get. It would be launched between May 2020, when the London Next mayoral contest is on. You would get a special print section. There would be 8 pages of in-depth material and research. There would be a multi-platform presence, some bespoke social media strategy. There would be some live debates, and everything would be branded, and that's fine. And then this, money can't buy. We expect every campaign to generate numerous news stories, comment pieces, and profile backing.
What's wrong with that?
Well, what happens is, for 500,000 inside this particular project, companies were being promised positive news and favorable comment.
In editorial.
Unbranded. In my term, that would be abusing their readership. If I buy a newspaper or I'm given a newspaper, I want to be able to know the distinction between what is editorial and what is not editorial. Now, in this particular instance, one company, Starbucks, looked at this and said, this is not for us. And the quote was, effectively, even though this was me speaking to an executive privately.
At Starbucks.
They said, we don't do this. We don't need to buy our reputation. In fact, the phrase he used was, this was PR death. This was public relations death. But Uber signed up to this and Google signed up to this. And there are four other companies.
So these companies have paid £500,000.
Right. So this project, London 2020, cost £3 million, which is commercial companies paying in. And for their cash, they're expected to get good news stories in the pages of a prominent, respected newspaper with a reputation. The project has apparently been, it's not necessarily shelved, but it was expected to launch on June the 5th and didn't happen. So the fallout from this story was huge. People objected to it politically. There's a court case involving Uber, supposed to be at the end of this month, and it looked as if Uber were looking for some positive news in the run into that. Uber have said nothing, Google have said nothing, and the Standard have shelved the project. And people have called for the resignation of George Osborne. They've said he has no place in journalism. If he wants to be successful, or he wants to have made his mark as a newspaper editor that has reputation and trust and has broken stories and that the Standard means something, this London 2020, where he sells parts of the pages of his newspaper, is not going to give him the reputation. In fact, it's going to be the reverse.
Are you surprised by any of this?
Yes and no. You know, advertisers have always had, to varying degrees, a considerable influence, I think, on the editorial output of newspapers. I think that the reality is that when newspapers are seen to go too far down or to stray too far down an acceptable script, if you like, to advertisers, that they do, kind of pull their
the long leash suddenly isn't
yeah,
the long leash.
There is a real fundamental problem with journalism in this country at the moment. And I think that it comes down to the fact that journalists are not being questioning enough of the scripts that are handed to them, or what, you know, Michel Foucault called regimes of truth that get established seemingly so quickly. I mean, another case in point is the Salisbury poisoning. You know, almost as soon as that happened, as soon as that hit the front pages, journalists were just echo chambers for whatever the government was saying on it. And, you know, there was an opposition, a leader of opposition, who was calling for a much more calm and reasoned approach and an evidence-based approach. And he was, in most of the press, dismissed as being a Kremlin stooge. And that's just an example. There are not enough journalists doing this kind of journalism.
Yeah, I think in the Salisbury case, you're a political journalist. You're in a time critical job. You want to report what the state says. The evidence is that this has happened, that poisoning has taken place, that people have almost lost their lives, and that there's a potential agent, which has been confirmed not by the government, but been confirmed by an expert international lab that can tell you what this is. It would be really difficult not to report that. And you would report it in such a way as that this is what the government said. I think what you're doing is you're making a massive jump between a reported statement and a statement of belief. Newspapers didn't necessarily believe this story, but they had a duty to report what the government said. They also had a duty to report what the leader of the opposition said, and did that. Again, I think you're jumping into a kind of a critical mindset. I don't think that reflects the hard job that would be to actually report that.
I'll come back to the Snowden issue, because you mentioned the criticality of time-sensitive journalism, yes, which is an absolute fair point. But actually, that extends way beyond that. So take, for example, the Sunday Times, which absolutely prides itself on being an agenda leader in terms of the news across the board. Yes. And in fact, studies have shown consistently that it is. Yes. Now, in 2015, we got an exclusive headline on the Sunday Times that was supposedly the product of a very long, in-depth investigation. And the headline was that Russia and China had gotten hold of the Snowden leaks, or words to that effect. Now, what happened is very quickly that story unraveled, because what was it based on? That entire in-depth investigation was based on two corroborated sources, both of them from the Foreign Office.
Yes, I know.
That's
exactly
what the Sunday Times thought was an in-depth investigation.
And I find it very difficult to believe that that journalist is still working at the Sunday Times.
I mean, some of the people with bylines on that story were very, very well-respected journalists, and I think that's an example of how journalism can just go horribly wrong when newsroom cultures do not actually allow for that kind of questioning, critical perspective that is so fundamental.
All of these things can be bundled together. And I think it comes down to a matter of trust. There's a future for newspapers if people who buy them trust them.
But they don't at the moment.
But things like this, London 2020 and the selling of content, or reporting that looks one-sided, or a lack of investigation which looks beyond a news agenda. If all those things happen in tandem, you sell parts of your newspaper, you don't invest in investigative journalism, you have one-sided reportage, trust is eroded. And if trust is eroded, there's no future for newspapers. So from my point of view, I'm trying to not knock down what newspapers are doing. I mean, I'm defending them against your analysis. I'm trying to make sure that there's a future for newspapers, because I've spent my entire life in them.
Also, outside of all of this, is that we have to look at the ideological alignment of newspapers across the board, from The Guardian and The Mirror right through to The Mail and The Sun.
Which is another show, and you should both come back and do
that,
it.
That is, you know, that is as much of a problem as anything else we've talked about.
Gentlemen, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
That's it from Renegade Inc. this week. You can drop the team a mail, studio@renegadeinc.com, or tweet us @RenegadeInc. Join us next week for more insight from those people who are thinking differently. But until then, stay curious.
Thank you for listening to the Renegade Inc. podcast. If you'd like to watch the episode or browse more of our content, you can find us at renegadeinc.com. Renegade Inc. was produced by Megan Ashcroft and Olivia Lebrun. Renegade Inc. is a Renegade Inc. production in association with Motherlode.